tips and techniques for writing fantasy? I wouldn't question.
Excellent, thank you.
Exactly. Yes, I went to a science fiction one, and that was basically across the board for writing anything.
Mm.
Like just, you know, doing it regularly, all that kind of stuff. Are there any specific tips for fantasy? Like, don't ever do this, or don't, or if you are going to do something, do it this way, because otherwise it's going to totally destroy.
Don't start in a tavern.
Don't eat stew.
Yeah. I think this comes down to world building. World building is really important. What I mean by world building is setting up a setting, actually technology's appropriate today. You don't have people burning wood on a fire when they're in a marsh with the trees and miles around, that sort of thing. Another thing I'd say is avoiding cliche. Which you probably do that a lot, but that was building.
Well, yeah, world building is a big one, because if you really want to build a world, just to pause on that for a moment, you can have a lot of fun, which is not just setting up technology. You can build mythologies. There was a panel the other day on religion in fantasy, and the concept that a society can be structured by its religious views. And you can see lots of examples of that around the world at the moment. But the thing you could really have fun with is the astrophysics of planets. See, the world, our world, has got seasons. Now, it's got seasons because the Earth's tilted at 23 degrees to a vertical. Now, if you've got a world that's not tilted, you don't have seasons. And so the weather patterns are very odd, because your weather patterns are completely determined by how far you are from the poles or the equator. So you can really mess with that big time. And if you want to have even more fun and have a different coloured sun, which would affect the sunset, the sunrise, the kind of planet. See, we're locked into the astrophysics and biology of a fairly small, fairly cool yellow sun with an almost circular orbit and a tilted planet. Change any one of those and you've got a different world. It's very funky. If you really want to have some fun, do what the planet Uranus can do, which is it's almost tilted to almost be facing the sun. So it's rolling that way instead of that way. That is cool, because then you've got one half of the planet which is bright and sunny and hot, the other end which is a freezing wasteland. And you've got a one end. And so what you can do then, if you want to go culturally, sorry, I'm getting excited because world building is really cool stuff, is then you can do culturally, you can have the super wealthy top dudes live in what we would call the equatorial band, which is nice and pleasant and nice, and then you've got the desert nomads at one end, and the ice nomads at the other end. Very cool. You can do great stuff with societies there. Then, of course, there's magic. See, we just throw magic in like, you know, willy-nilly. And I'm not talking about determining what magic is, but what if magic was an underground thing? What if it was highly prized? What if there are two countries that butt up against each other, one side which really eschews magic, the other side which is really keen on magic? This side does technology, that side does magic. World building is cool.
Yeah, what you need to remember, I think, though, is, well, I mean, I agree that straight away not being a world builder so much, because my stuff is based on, I guess, this world and this world's history, with the magical component thrown in. You've got to have a logic, an internal logic in your book.
Absolutely.
And sometimes people starting out writing fantasy think anything goes, you know, it's fantasy, I can make it up. And I think that one of the places where people fall down most commonly is with the element of magic.
Absolutely.
Because most of us probably don't see magic much in our everyday lives, and so we don't perhaps understand that it has to have its own logic and its own rules. And within your book, those rules have got to make sense. I have found, interestingly enough, when I write, you know, something that's based on real history, that people accept a lot of the supernatural elements in the book. They're quite prepared to accept that someone might, you know, turn into an animal and vice versa or whatever, but if I make real world errors, I'll pick them up. But certainly I've been picked up often on not so much illogical elements of the magic, but needing to know in my own mind how everything works, even though I don't explain all that within the book. If I know the mechanics of it, if I know the logic of it, then that's going to come out in the way I write about it. And an example of, I guess, where I think someone went off the rails with that, and you may disagree with me, is the Twilight series, where she, you know, whatever you think of it, you know, they're readable, three of them are readable, But having sort of got this concept that she obviously sold, that was the, you know, the romance between the girl and the vampire, she hadn't really thought about the physicality of her vampire characters and just exactly how all that worked and the heart of marble and all the rest of it, you know, and I think really got herself in a terrible, terrible tangle with the fourth book, trying to, you know, make it right for everybody and happy endings for everybody, and it simply physically doesn't work. So be careful of that sort of thing. If you're going to write about paranormal beings or creatures, you need to know how their physiology works within your world, and they need to be able to interrelate with the other characters in a way that, you know, it makes sense for us as a reader.
I know that's sort of a rule, but the first one is obey the laws of physics where possible. The second rule is, if you don't obey the laws of physics, make sure you have a fancy explanation for it. Don't just, you know, not explain it. I made a mistake with my second series where I had a twins that had been
conjoined.
Who had in the past separated themselves, and they were different genders. And me not doing my research, not realising that if you put conjoined twins, of course they are of the same gender. That was actually kind of good, because when I came to when this was pointed out to me, I went, well, actually, I'll make one of them change gender by magic. But I hadn't explained this in the first book, so I get people on the internet saying, hey, huge plot hole, yeah, blah, 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 she got it wrong. Now, even though I have explanation for it eventually, in the third book, people will assume that if you don't explain something that's not following the laws of physics, that's a mistake. My third rule, the third part of this rule is, if you have something that's explained by magic, don't then try and explain it by physics. Well, at least be very careful to do it. I think the prime example is a very good writer who just made one really dizzy the mistake, I think. And she had flying horses. And then she decided that, well, laws of physics probably say that the flying horses are probably too heavy to fly. You don't understand why evolution would produce a flying horse that was too heavy to fly. But so she put anti-gravity horseshoes on them. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the horse will fly upside down. You have to be very careful if you're going to try and use physics to explain. So if the first mistake she made was assume that biology would allow this to happen, like why on earth would a horse develop if it didn't work? Or that the reader couldn't just go, they're flying horses, we get it.
Exactly. The precedent for flying horses in mythology, so you can probably get away with that one.
Yeah.
It's also things that can pick up elephants that fly. The point is this, if you're dealing with magic, don't assume that all of your characters know about magic. We didn't know about Newtonian physics until 4 centuries ago. How do you think people thought the laws of physics worked before then? They just did what worked. The same thing can happen with magic. You don't have to have this elaborately worked out system of laws. What you need are events that are self-consistent. And that doesn't mean the same thing. People before Newton didn't realise that force equals mass times acceleration. They didn't know that force is something that you apply to an object which produces acceleration in some fashion. They got along all the same, you know, by swinging hammers and pushing ploughs and having mills. And yeah, they didn't know how it worked, they just knew it worked. The same thing can apply if you use magic. Your magic system doesn't have to be worked out in elaborate detail for it to work in the reader's mind. It doesn't even have to be apparently really consistent, as long as it works in the reader's mind, given this willing suspension of disbelief, which is what we're about here. Willing suspension of disbelief. You are working on the goodwill of the reader, and it is your business to obtain and retain that goodwill. And they'll do it for you, as long as you can make it work for them. There's this famous example, you know, when William Golding wrote The Boys on the Desert Island, Lord of the Flies, Picky starts a fire. Picky is short-sighted. Picky starts a fire by concentrating the rays of the sun through his eyeglasses. As soon as you see this, anybody who knows the physics of optometry will know that this is impossible. He's short-sighted. His glasses scatter light. They don't concentrate it. Did this stop Lord of the Flies from becoming, you know, as soon as this was pointed out, did everybody say, nonsense, you throw it away? No. But people still talk about the detail that makes them fall out of the text. And, yeah, it could be all sorts of details. I fell out of Raven's Fight's second last book because we had Pug torturing people and getting information from them. I object to people torturing people and getting information from them because it doesn't happen. What happens when you torture someone for information? I'll tell you anything. You know? Anything will make you stop. Anything that might make you stop. Anything that might happen, you know, anything that could possibly prevent you from going ahead. But Pug gets good information from them. Does he have a lie detector? No. He's not magical. He's putting them through agony, and they're telling him the truth. Garbage. It's not going to happen. I fell out of the text at that point. Not because it's impossible for Pug to be putting lighted matches up someone's bottom. It's because it's impossible the result came out.
Oh, no.
Pig 4
was magic, is the Deus
Ex Machina. Deus Ex Machina.
Thank you.
Yeah,
you need to make sure that whatever magical system you put in place is whatever constructs there are to it. So that you
Chekhov's
don't have
these
points where
at the
end.
Chekhov's law.
Yeah. God, some God turns up.
God turns up and fixes everything on another page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's very easy for them to accidentally happen. I do remember, so was it the first rule?
Yes.
I think there's a point in that book where, and I call it an as-you-move-up. But the characters get, there's a female character who's got special magic powers, I don't remember the exact details. There's a wise old guardian who's just taken along with a young man. And I get ambushed, and the wise old man and the young boy get paralysed by magic, while these guys start doing nasty things to the woman. Now, she starts to glow. So the old man turns to the young man and says, as you know, well, no, he didn't say that, but he... well, in this particular kind of magical power, she can, you know, person, she can be blah, 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 she's blah, 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 blah. And that saves the day. It's like, classic.
How do you talk to someone more paralysed?
Well,
yeah,
that's part of the
laws of paralysis. There are levels of paralysis. That's quite serious. It's all three parts.
Thank you very much.
Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe
they'll go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Part of the thing with magic, I think, is not to overdo it.
Yes.
Use it sparingly if you can, so that it retains the gosh wow bit. Because if it's, I'll just cast a lightning bolt over there, another one over there, oh, magic was, oh, down the back, yep, you'll be good. I'll paralyze you down the back, you'll be good. What a waste of time. Yeah, so you keep the gosh wow factor if you can, and use it as minimum, as little as the plot will allow. Yes.
If your main character...
Sorry, Sarah's behind you. Sorry.
If you were writing a text and you decided there's no magic, there's no fantastical beings, but you're just society building. You've created the world so you can start a society at the beginning of history and just move it forward. Is that still considered fantasy?
It's alternate history. Going back to a very... So it's a branch of science fiction. Remember, however, that you are breaking the categories laws of major publishers, and therefore you are most likely not going to get published.
Well, it's not all Jennifer Fallon's second series, I think it's called Second Son. It's published fantasy, it's considered fantasy, it's written in a fantasy tone, which is one way of getting away with it. It has absolutely no magic in whatsoever. It's about the fact that these people believe something that's not true.
Yours might not be alternate history because it's only alternate history that uses real world history and changes it. You know, what if?
But what if you like go back and create an entirely new history?
Unless you're going to go back to the Jurassic or before, you can't.
Or stick it on another planet.
And if it's on another planet, is it science fiction or fantasy?
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, why worry about the name? Write a good story.
Unfortunately, there's a reason.
You don't need to define what you're writing. You write the book and then, you know, if it's a fabulous book, someone will publish it.
Let people decide for themselves what genre it is.
Yeah. But what will stop, because of marketing reasons, what good books won't get published?
Take it from either end. What good books won't get published? Overwhelmingly, books won't get published that don't fit into a publisher's mental category of what they publish.
Yeah.
This means that your primary and most important piece of information that you go to a publisher with is what does that publisher publish? What exactly does it publish? If it publishes reams and lots of heroic fantasy, then what you bring to that publisher has to be fairly close to being romantic fantasy, heroic fantasy. It's no good going to a publisher who publishes basically dark fantasy and horror with a light romance. They won't want it. You have to research what the publisher does. Publishers are people who are in the business of producing fruit. As far as they're concerned, their readership has a loyalty to one particular genre, and they pick up loyalties to authors within that genre. If you're not one of those authors, which you're not if this is your first time trying to get a thing published, then you have to be in the mainstream of what they do. I differ from most people in believing that publishers don't really care whether it's really good or not. The first question they ask themselves is, do I publish this? Is this going to fit in my list? And the answer to that is no, it doesn't matter how good it is.
That's true, but what you will be doing as a writer will be writing your book and then researching publishers and finding a publisher who will be interested in your book. You won't be researching publishers and thinking, Voyager likes X kind of book, that's what I'll write. The book comes first, the journey around the publishing stable comes next. Now, people can just disagree with me on that. Obviously, sometimes people will feel that they're going to try to tailor whatever they're going to write to the market. But I really do believe, I think there's got to be some integrity in what you write. I think you've got to write the story that's within you to write. And you'll write it in a well-informed way because you will have read, we hope, within your genre and broadly outside your genre, and you will have educated yourself about publishing. But I think in most cases, it's very difficult to tailor a book to the market. I think you've got to write, from the heart, not from some sort of mechanical exercise. There might be some exceptions to that. There are some people who work very well as what I call a journeyman writer who will, for example, write titles in an ongoing series, like, something based on a TV series or whatever, and they'll probably write their own books on the half as well.
Yeah, I think there's an extra reason why that's so true is because if you try and tailor, you can't be sure the publisher will... Books take a long time to write. You can't be sure the publisher will still be after the same thing. When you get there, you can't be sure that a publishing company will have the same commissioning editor by the time you have this, because they move around a lot. If you can be really, really clever, not just get to know what the publishers publish, but get to know what the individual commissioning editors are like, because then you know exactly who is. And if they change publishing companies, then that won't stand.
The SF writing panel, they suggested that you write the story you want to write that you're passionate about, and that's your first draft, and then you look at what publishers are after or selling or what's marketable, and then you make the changes to tailor the story to make it more. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't on that. Not totally in that.
That would be
really hard. Yeah, it would be tough. I would just write the book. And something that's come up just in the last couple of minutes I'll talk about is, you hear about these authors who have been rejected by ex-publishing companies. My response is, why didn't you go to the right publishing company in the first place? So if you're going to a publishing house and they say, oh, this is good, but you've got to write it as a romantic fiction, for crying out loud, it's epic fantasy, find another publisher.
They also said there's only a limited amount of publishing houses now, like 20 or whatever, so it might be that what you're writing doesn't fit into any of their...
In time changes, and what they want changes, series. She did everything wrong, according to what I've been taught, that the system is finished up publishers. She didn't have an agent, she sent it straight. Unsolicited. Well, in those days, I think it was okay to send things on the business. And then she sends... She didn't write the whole thing. They say to you, when you write fantasy, you need to write the whole thing, because they're going to want the rest. So I know you can finish something. She wrote a couple of chapters and a synopsis and sent that off to all of the publishers at once. Now, simultaneous submissions is something that a lot of publishers really do not like, and unless you ban writers, if they discover this is happening. So I've been told. But it just turned out that she wrote a book about witches, and all the publishing companies she sent it to, or most of them, said, we don't know if you've written any books about witches lately. I mean, we need to write a book about witches. And so she had a bidding war. Even though she'd broken all these rules. It doesn't mean anyone get away with it, except,
doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often, but no worries. Was she an exception to the rule? And she just happened to have a book on witches at a point where they went, no, we've been writing about witches for a while. I think that would be really fun. Sometimes.
But you will notice here, please notice, the question that occurs to the publishers even on those who are on the pro-publisher side of this panel, which starts about there. even those who are on the pros are saying that the publishers are buying a book not because they see, this is brilliant, we'll put it out. They're saying, oh, it's a book about witches. We need a book about witches. They are selling, buying books like you buy fruit.
Oh, yeah, they buy what they can sell. I mean, that's remember, they're...
No,
they're
not necessarily. Not necessarily, Bevan. I would have a great deal more respect for this process if it was more than randomly efficient.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah, bear in mind that each of us is coming here with our own, you know, personal baggage from the journey towards publication. We're probably, possibly all have had different experiences with different publishers, and each one of us has also probably dealt with more than one publishing house, and I bet everybody's had both good and bad experiences. So I was going to just say a bit more about your question about, you know, whether you do your first draft of the book from the heart and then alter it. I mean, once an editor has seen your book and liked it or half liked it, you certainly will be asked to make changes. But I think that there's no correct answer to that question, because everybody writes in a different way. You've got to bear in mind that there are some people who'll do their whole first draft and then do a whole bunch of changes themselves. There are people who'll change as they go, and so everyone comes to it in a different way. But I would certainly concur with what Bevan said, you know, that you've really, it's got to be your own book. And I would think that there are, despite the fact that publishers, they do want a product, they want something that will sell, they know their market, so they're going to pick up something that they think will work, because why would you do otherwise? But there are some publishers who'll go out on a limb and take risks and will publish, you know, something that's a little bit different. And if you come up with a book that is strikingly different, as, you know, as I was talking yesterday about something that's called high concept, where you've got a very, very original idea that you've done really well, and particularly, I think, in YA fiction that applies, that there are some very unusual books being picked up these days that you can't say are like anything that that publisher has published before. So they're on the lookout for something that's brilliant and original too.
At the end of the day, I would say, write your book, put it out there, see what happens. Because everybody has different stories. Kate Forsyth gets picked up because she writes at the right time. Other people write a book they firmly believe in and they submit it for years and finally find someone that wants. Just write it, put it out there, and see what happens.
Because the market changes, do publishers ever get something, don't put it out, but put it out 10 years later when the market's changed?
Well, you have to keep buying rights for it, so the incentive to not publish it is... The deterrent to do that is quite strong.
No, I don't know of any publisher who thinks more than their next list. Probably, you know, they'll think a year ahead. Remember that acceptance times for manuscripts are stretched out into years, because, you know, everybody in the company has to act as a gatekeeper. This has been the practical result of the companies amalgamating. Books are actually being scheduled by creeps in suits who've never read a fantasy haven't read a fiction text since they've been in high school, and whose qualifications for their job consists of their big hair. I'm sorry, this has been the result of this frantic amalgamation and coming together that the publishers have been doing for the last 10 or 15, 20 years. You know, the superstructures that they've accumulated have resulted in the result that they're baseline people that you deal with, the editors, so they don't really have any power in the corporation. The corporation resides with the marketers and the accountants and the people who couldn't give a hoot about what they buy.
But do the editors get feedback from the marketer from that sells, that doesn't, that sells, that doesn't,
no,
that will sell next year?
No, I don't. Not that I know. The marketers are dreadful at predicting what the market will do.
Then they're
incompetent. Yes.
Question. Do you think once you've written that first book and you have put it out there, is it possible that you reach a point where you become too precious about that and try and hold on to that, as opposed to going forward and writing the next idea?
Try and avoid that.
Yeah, I think I always subscribe to the idea if you write a book, you send it out there, and while it's out there, you write another one.
Yeah.
While that one's out there, you write another one.
Yeah, you've got to start on project B before you start to get your rejection slips, you know.
And every one of us here can paint the garage with our rejection slips.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
stuffed out of the manuscript out, it must have got lost in the mail, so then we get rejection. That's the second time I sent it to an editor and I'm onto it for 2 years, stringing me along, never really intended to publish it,
yeah.
Which I think is actually quite unethical and emotionally ignorant to other people as
well.
But they do. So yeah, I consider myself the world's most unrejected.
Sarah.
When you do get rejected and you start, you know, losing heart in your own work, what is it that you can do to continue on with your writing?
Have a bottle of champagne with you. Drink that thing for a week and then get back into it.
Yeah. I found just writing another one helped. And also a little bit of, dare I say, simple bloody mindedness, which is you're just an idiot editor who doesn't understand what's going on. I'm going to go somewhere else. Now, I don't think that very often because I try to be polite, but I think I'm probably going to stand out of line here a little bit, but I think there's a degree of arrogance involved in writing a book and putting it out there. It's, I've written this, I think it's good, you should publish it. You don't think it's good, that's fine, that's your problem. They will think it's good.
So we sort of bring up our egos, drink lots of alcohol and keep on being...
Let's go on the binge for a week.
Good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote down, I didn't have tips and tricks very much today, but I've written that down. I've written, first off, that you need to learn the craft of writing. Second, you need to learn how to do hard work, because it's not a case of sort of sitting somewhere picturesque and scrawling a few lines of damn hard slog. You must have the courage of your convictions. If you don't believe in yourself as a writer, you won't be able to do it. Mm. You can't afford to sort of...
But when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and the sentence will not come right.
And you've got to have a good story to tell. That's my last one.
Oh, sorry. But there will come the time when the sentence won't come right, or the character won't do what the character needs to do for the plot, because you've installed that filter which says this character is not going to do that. But it's almost as if the character walks up behind you and taps you on the shoulder and says, I'm not going to do that. And when that happens, you have got to be prepared to rejig the whole fucking thing all over again.
I take that as a very positive. When my characters say, I'm not doing that, or they go off and do what they want to do, I think that's a real big positive, because it means to me that the character has become so real that I know what they're going
to
do.
Yeah, and once the character is that real to you, there's at least a chance that they're going to become that real to somebody else.
Yeah. I'm currently wrestling with a scene where I've got two characters that are going to do some, and last night one of them walked away. And I've still got my notebook here trying to work out how the heck to get this idiot back. And he's not coming back, so I'm going to have to redo a whole scene. I'm quite annoyed about it. Yes.
Are there any particular tropes that should definitely be avoided at all costs upon the pain of death?
The old mentor.
There's still a market out there for the young boy who's hidden in a village somewhere, who'd been brought up and actually happens to be heir to the kingdom, and he's nice, wise, and mentor, and takes him out and runs. It's a great adventure, and it's this gorgeous female who's actually quite sprightly. There's still a market for it. As long as it's written well.
There'll always be a
problem. But I still realise,
really,
please don't write.
I was going to just show you a couple of books. I won't talk at length about either of these, but if you want to read a bit and get a bit of background on how those tropes from mythology still make their way into just about every fantasy book that's written, and you don't have to, write Star Wars again or whatever. This one is called The Writer's Journey by Christopher Vogel, which is... an excellent book, great illustrations. It has, someone's going to say something about it in a minute. Has practical exercises if you want to do it, do them, and 45 Master Characters by Victoria Lynn Schmidt. If you want to get the details, you can come up and get them later. I particularly liked this one, and I really believe that there's still room for those ancient stories, because I think that they sort of encapsulate some values that are never going to be unimportant to the way we live our lives.
The story,
and I like this one particularly, because I'm not going to take ages, I promise, but it deals with archetypal characters, and it's got a very interesting chapter that will tell you how a man's archetypal journey varies, or the masculine journey is different from the feminine journey, and that both your male and female characters could embark on either. That the stages of development of the character are different in each case. It doesn't hurt to read a bit of this sort of stuff. You don't have to agree with everything they say. You don't have to do what they say. But it might sort of open you up a little bit as a writer to realising that you can write that style of story without replicating what, three zillion second-rate fantasy writers that, you know, done over the last 40 years. You've got to do something different than original with it.
Yeah, so do you study archaeology and different societies and how they run and things like that to get some, develop your characters?
And so I'm just setting myself when it comes to what form. I read books, I watch documentaries, I watch films, I watch different. It's all about story and it's all about
science. So 101 at archaeology at uni is not a bad
scribe.
History. Something just on that, can I just finish it? There's a marvellous publishing house called Austro Publications who publish brilliant military histories. So if you've got a fantasy with fights in it, which, you know, face it, it's fantasy, check out a particular warrior history. There's the Elite series and the Man of War series. Really cool set. Osprey Publications. And base your... this is just one suggestion. Base your military structure in an actual military structure that worked. Because, of course, you're going to get people who... been ex-soldiers who are in the army, they really think, oh, what a crap, that's not going to happen. So if you base your military history in something that worked, pick the winning side, you know. So Osprey Publications got the best set of ancient warriors you could find. Everything. Mongols, Celts, a lot.
If you're going to have military in your books, don't be afraid to get your hands dirty and read some military history. If it's at all important about your book, if you're going to have a battle, if you're going to have a military in your society that functions, then have a functioning military.
Buy a sword. Seriously.
I fought an armor and shield of the SCA. I mean, you are using a bamboo, but it's the same weight. It's weighted to be the same as padded, so you're not going to actually kill any. And your personal armour, you try fighting and putting in armour.
Yeah.
Feel what it's like and smell what it's like. And all of that stuff. You know, I did it for about 4 or 5 years. You don't need to do it a lot, but this experience will stick with you. They say write what you know. If you are going to write something that you don't know about, find out about it.
Even get a bow and arrow.
Just a detail. If you have got people who've got bare arms with a long bow, which is drawn to there, that string as it comes through is going to take the skin off the inside of your arm.
I can't with the bear.
That's why the Amazons. Do you know what the Amazon about the Amazons? Amazon means amazos, which means no breast. They cut their left breast off so they could shoot. That's what the word came from.
That's what Herodotus says, but Herodotus is,
a male.
Probably so they distracted down a bit.
That's the derivation.
Yeah. People just develop one's a book, one's
an internet site.
First one is Diana Lynn Jones, Tough Guy.
The Tough Guy to
Bad. Not only will you just look at it and go, it's got like a section on colour coding, so what colour your eyes are and what they're likely to be, and you go, oh, God, I've done that too. Girl with the violet eyes has always, got magical powers. Yellow eyes are always evil. and then her chapter on horses is hilarious. She talks about how, horses are treated like cars in fantasy. They never have to eat, they never have to be rubbed down, they never step on their foot, and so
like it.
And she figures that they must breed by pollination.
Horses don't have sex.
Diana Lynn Jones' Tough Guide to Fantasy Land is really important. And the second thing is this website called The Top 100 Things I'd Do If I Ever Became an Evil Overlord.
Oh, I love the one that says the force field generator shall be inside the force field. All the air ducts will be too small to climb through.
My intellectual ducts will be too small to crawl through. My noble half-brother, whose throne I usurped, will be killed. Not kept anonymously in prison and forgotten cell of my dungeon.
And all my evil plans shall be looked over by a 5-year-old.
That's George Lucas should have hit the thing. Cheating is not too good for my enemies.
Never underestimate the pettiness of evil overlords.
Oh, yes. I'm not glued to my enemies' predicament before killing them.
If you can get somebody like... getting away with the High Overlord Galacticus, Exarch what's his name in the Scattered Sons? I mean,
geez.
Anything. You can get away with anything provided you have the insouciance, provided you have the insistence that's real to you. And the other thing, but when we come down to all of this, remember, you don't explain all of this to the audience. Yes, you have your mind saturated with your world and with the mythic reality of it and with the reality of your characters. And all of this is integrated in your mind. It comes out on the page. You must know it all. You must be able, if necessary, to answer questions about it. Pose the questions yourself. Get other people to pose questions for you. Yeah, saturate your mind, but don't explain it. On the page, the worst thing you can do is explain why the people do this, and explain why the world is like this, and explain that the point where the sun is, and explain what the seasons do. Don't explain. Don't tell us. It's got to be part of the structure which is sitting in your mind. But you don't explain what it is. It just happens naturally on the page.
And part of that, just to follow on from exactly that, part of that is don't insult your reader. This is a really weird world. Let the reader work it out. The readers are smart. Readers are intelligent. Let them think it. Don't sit down, oh, and by the way, the world doesn't have an axis on it. Tilt on its axis. Oh, crap. Let the reader work it out.
What happens if it becomes too
confusing? Sorry? What happens if it becomes...
What happens if your world becomes too confusing? Is that because it's...
If it's confusing to you, it will be confusing to the reader. But the important thing is that you are not confused. If you are not confused, then you are not going to give conflicting information. You are not going to provide the reader with impossible to resolve conflicts. The purpose is, if you tell everything, it's like striptease. Once you show everything, there's nothing more to show.
So you might decide to set puzzles for the reader, or lead the reader down, sort of confusing alleyways. You will often choose not to make something very clear early on. And I think there are a couple of kinds of readers. There are some readers who like to understand exactly what's happening at all stages, and there are readers who are prepared to sort of suspend themselves in the soup of the book, if you like, or something like that. Very good kind of, they don't mind being slightly puzzled because the writing or the story is sufficiently compelling, provided the reader can solve the puzzle before the end of the book, or provided it becomes sufficiently clear, then it's going to work.
I think for yourself, you need to keep copious notes. I have a big pinboard in front of my desk where I put maps and diagrams of rooms and things like that, lists of characters' names, and any facts about the world that I think are relevant. And also, in computer files, I'll have more about the world. I have little subtitles, culture, things like that, and what the world's like, geography, biology, all that sort of stuff, anything that's special to the world I'll put into a document. And I can keep consulting that. Sometimes I forget what I've written, and I have to go back and, I said that, it doesn't work with what I've done. But at least I've got one spot that I can keep checking and keep changing if I want to.
Do you recommend not reading fantasy while you're trying to write it, so you don't inadvertently bias yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Or at least if that's specific to the...
Finds if I read Jane Austen and I'm writing fantasy, I'd tell you I'd write Jane Austen in language. Don't have to demonstrate that later.
Yeah.
I don't think reading fantasy itself is going to be a problem.
Just read.
Read everything. Read particularly non-fiction. Terry Pratchett. To channel Terry Pratchett. Yeah, so the thing you have to read is non-fiction. But remember that it's not going to turn up in your books as explanation for historical events. It's going to be part of the background that is what you write. I mean, Pratchett could not have come up with the 303 bookworm unless he had actually studied the characteristics of 303 rifles. Or the hermit elephant, unless he'd made a connection between elephants and crabs. And that connection couldn't have existed if he didn't know about either. Or both, in fact. When I interviewed him, he was talking about spelunking, caves. Why was he talking about it? He was reading everything he could possibly do and joining a caving society so he could go down caves in northern England. Why was he doing this? Because he was going to write his next book about dwarves and about living underground. And he wanted to get that fixed in his mind. When I told him about the helictites, which in West Australian caves are those strange things that grow horizontally and can even grow straight up, he was frantically interested in this because it made a thing that he could anchor his world with. That's what you've got to do too. You've got, and remember, what anchors your world is not vast sweeps of visions. It's tiny little details. But for me, reading the play here, Connie Willis's, the play here, one of the things that anchored it, even though I knew a lot of the historical sweep wasn't true. Dark Age is a story of me. I know that when you have a plague through, a big plague through, even the Black Death, even the worst of all, some proportion of the population survives. 25%, some say 30%, but in spot places it can be worse, and 15% are all that survive. But nowhere do you get a situation where you've got village communities where nobody survives. I knew Wallace Willis was wrong about that. But for me, the thing was anchored by the fact that she told me the people kept pigeons for meat. They kept chickens for eggs. Then poultry was doves. And suddenly the whole world gelled. That whole economic system became real. Fantasy, well, historical fantasy, is found in the detail. Pick up a telling detail.
There are two perils with all the research you do. The first one is you end up with a whole lot of other stories that crop up.
Yep.
And the second one is you become insufferably expert on everything. And so you can't enjoy things when you read them because something will be wrong, or you start telling people that they're wrong.
Yeah. You're putting it me for a reason there.
And if you need something to happen that isn't historical, just have it happen. Just have it happen.
It is fantastic. I think I've got a book on clay, history of clay. And reading this book, just not particularly researching for anything at all, but just I'm constantly curious. Most writers that you find are constantly curious. And reading about how clay was used to make fertility, goddesses and stuff. And the first thing that popped into my head was a great idea for a short story, because why did these archivists always assume that it's about goddesses and religion and stuff? Why didn't these fertility goddesses come out of some guy going out in the river with a big lump of clay and going, it looks like all the boobs? Not even a war! I reckon their early statues were just porn. Great idea for a short story.
Thanks.
One of the things we haven't talked about is the whole sort of language, culture and names issue. That's something that's really easy to get wrong in a fantasy book, and it helps a lot if you have a reasonable knowledge of cultures other than your own, and it also helps if you have a knowledge of languages other than the one that you're writing in to indent names for your world, whether your world is, sort of a historical real world or whether it's completely indented. I don't know how many people get on, but this is something that as a reader I find very difficult in some fantasy, but some people have the gift for inventing names that work together, that sound like they all belong to the same culture, and some people have no idea and mix names pinched or slightly altered from, 30 our world cultures that don't go together, and that, and for me, immediately sort of starts to invalidate, if you like, the culture that they've set up. So you do need to be aware of that. I mean, it's true that fantasy gets published with this flaw in it, so obviously some people are not sort of attuned to it.
If you read some of those books, it says a whole lot of names and their meaning, and they go, this girl, the character I've got to like to swim, this name. Characters have got red hair, not the name of that fire, and it's like India and Celtic culture. And
there must have been on that score. You can have some fun with that. So I got my first book. There was a society which I based on the Celtic mythos, and I used a lot of the Celtic names. And I quite deliberately, and I actually got criticised for this in a review once, I think, I quite deliberately picked Scottish, Welsh, and Irish names, Celtic names, quite deliberately, so that I could show by the fact that these names were slightly different to those ones. Mm-hmm. They had a basic to show that the society was fragmenting, mm-hmm. like the Irish, the Welsh, and the Scottish. I said quite deliberately, and someone wrote a review saying, "Oh, you couldn't sort out what names it was. He's Scottish." I thought, well, okay, but you missed the point of deliberately doing the fragmentation.
Sure. Do you think there's a temptation when people are like fencing with respect to names that they tend to overcomplicate them and make them difficult to read?
Pass the man a book.
Definitely.
Because
otherwise,
the Scrabble board
and
picked all the letters that
have
the highest.
Like, throw them in the air and pick them up. Oh,
It's not too much to ask you as a fantasy writer to have some sort of parallel society that you've got in your mind. I mean, yeah, is it ancient Hyrcanian society? Is it Turanian? Is it African? And to go back to the culture, to the records of that culture, and have a look at who are the kings. There's usually kings lists. There's nearly always some sort of record of people's names. And names often have elements that repeat. So you've got a series of ingredients, at least, that you can put in a blender.
I think that's a naming convention. Actually, I have three ways they come up with names. The first one is when I'm really first writing down the sketch of the backpack, but remember what something or what the story is, and I need a name, and often I'll just look up and just grab someone's name and then subvert, and that's how I've got Sonia. It's not spelled the same way. But what I then do is I then establish a naming convention for each of the races. And cultures.
Yep.
So yeah, it's like in our culture, yes. In particular, the girls both are, and our names always turn to end with E, and Wendy, and Debbie, mm-hmm. and Trudy, and yeah, it's always, and the guys would be quite different, they have their own naming conventions. So I have, for different genders, I have different naming conventions within that culture. And then the second way is a naming convention. The third way, even though I really can't come up with a name, I hit my head with a keyboard.
And add vowels.
And then just make it fit the naming convention.
I've got one something similar to that. There's a couple of wonderful websites. One is Babel Fish, which is the alphabet.
Yes,
translates. So if I've got a culture and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to base that culture on, I think a country, Dutch. So I go to Babel Fish and I type a sentence or a paragraph describing the country. Really old society made of pretentious prats who wouldn't know their left foot from their right. And I translate it into Dutch, so I get Dutch words, and then I take the Dutch words and stick them onto a word mixing program I've got somewhere else on the net, and scramble them, and that gives me 300 scrambled words, and then I pick the names that have got the similar language structures, like the double A for Dutch, that are short. Oh, that's a name, I'll have that one. Oh, God. Oh, that's a name, I'll have that one. And so they've got the same language structures as
well,
the original language.
What I'm going to do is actually my book where, you know, when you're on a blog and it's got the security thing, you've got to type in the letters that come up. I'd like to have the entire nation of names that came up.
Just another website is behindthename.com.
Use it every day.
Behindthename.com. You can look for names from different places. And also top 100 lists for different places. And there's a random name generator which you can have all the different names, plus creative and gothic names or witch names or fairy names. It'll come up with them.
You can go too far down this route, but one thing to look for is, yeah, okay, what is the language of the people that you're writing about? What sort of language do they speak? I can recommend a book by Jack Vance, The Languages of Pau, P-A-O, which is about how societies are shaped by the languages they use. There's a lot less to this idea than there was thought to be originally, but nevertheless, it's got something to it. And as an historian, there's only one other thing that I'd say, and that is that you are applying a philosophy of history to any society that you write that has got antecedents. You are applying a philosophy of history. Be careful that that philosophy of history that you are showing doesn't show too much or that you're preaching it. For example, technological determinism. Are societies founded and shaped by the technology they use? That's a philosophy of history. the great man idea of history, the man who counts idea of history, is one that fantasists go with very much. Criticise it. Be prepared to criticise it. Are societies really the creation of a series of small numbers of individuals with genius, with personal genius? Or are they the creation of huge numbers of people who are working for of our actors working on causes they don't particularly know? Are we the product of great people? Or are we the product of the mass? Have a look at what your underlying philosophy is about society. If you are going to create a society, that underlying philosophy is going to be what that society is about. Be prepared to criticise.
I'm just wondering, out of interest, everything that you said for the last hour about, you know, physics, like subtle magic rather than correct explosion, the right names, doesn't everything, do you think that applies, does that apply in the same way to young adult and children? Is it fantasy? Because, I know it's not what you guys necessarily write, but, you know, they do like the Big Bang, and they're not going to be quite as critical, and they will accept that something is just magic.
I'll start off by saying that I would accept all the same writing standards and content standards for my adult writing, adult or young adult. The only difference for me is that a young adult book is shorter, and there are certain things that my adult doesn't like me to put into a young adult book, so I don't put stuff like the logic of use of magic and being consistent about naming and historical accuracy and so forth, absolutely the same for both.
Yeah, definitely. Don't insult children.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Give them a proper story, which is, absolutely. Don't insult them.
Well, they do. One of the things that happens is that the magic should be self-consistent. And this is the thing, you can use that self-consistency to lead them into implications that they didn't think about. And that is part of the pleasure. It really is part of the pleasure of walking into this genre, that you can use magic to lead people into the implications of wider things. I mean, I said to a primary school class, we were talking about the Ariana series, you have things that you can do that nobody else can do. Isn't that magic? Yeah? What I'm talking about when my protagonist comes into the full strength of being able to do magic, What am I really talking about? I'm talking about growing up. I'm talking about coming into powers. And the fact that I can lead them into this by a discussion of my story about someone coming into her magical powers is leading them in the way into implications that they're thinking about. But as to not having large scale magical effects. On Tamar's 13th birthday, her biological clock triggered the integration of her consciousness with the advanced extraterrestrial soul mind of the Anunnaki Queen Kali, who had been lying dormant in our daughter's non-coding DNA since her conception. In less than a week, Tamar developed into a beautiful, more mature, more intelligent, and infinitely more powerful being than any other being on Earth. Those are the published and professionally edited words of a published and professionally large-selling author. I shall not say who.
Was that aimed at kids or adults?
Adults.
There's a question right in the back. Yes.
For the panel, what in your mind is an outstanding piece of fantasy novel or novella or fantasy piece of work? And what was the key element in that that made it so outstanding for you?
Pick one.
Something that sticks in mind.
Ursula Le Guin, yes. A Wizard of Earthsea, mm-hmm. One sentence. Get has become a falcon.
Yes.
I'll see if I can recite the sentence exactly. And for that time, he knew nothing but what the falcon knows, the feel of the wind, and how he knows it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's Ursula K. Le Guin. And if you can read that and not think, well, okay, you're not in this genre. But to have someone write a sentence like that, a sentence that sings like that, and not think, I want to study for the next 900 years, and maybe if I do that, I will be able to write something like that. No, okay. But that's Ursula K. Le Guin.
Michael Moorcock's Elric series. In terms of dark fantasy, seminal work. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. It's cliched now, but oh, really good. Loved it. No, we're waiting, Tracy.
Little Big by John Crowley, which is a classic of folkloric fantasy, written I think about in the 1970s, and it's one of those indescribable books that takes someone who appears to live in a 19th century sort of Victorian style world back into, or through, into what's called a polis, sort of through doors, if you like, into the world within, which is larger than the world without. That's all I can say. It's a wonderful, challenging read that sort of opens your mind to all sorts of possibilities, and has, I can't quote, but it has the most beautiful use of language. So I don't think John Crowley's later work ever quite matched up to that, which is a little bit sad. He got a bit hung up on sort of the occult and demons and all that stuff. But Little Big is a beautiful work that everybody should read at this point.
I'm going to go for something light and easy to read. Tennis Lee's The Black Unicorn. Just the world building in this is subtle and rich and fantastic. Her main character is a girl who's got a great way with machines and making herself. And her mum's the sorceress. She's not the magic, except she's just quite messy and just straight magic, just fly everywhere and occasionally affect things. And it's just so nice to have that sort of role reversal where she's technically, she can fix anything, she can make anything. And but she's not the little sorceress.
That's anymore, cool.
So she roams out in the world and has adventures. And that's her strength. So it tips it on its head. And she just writes these little books that are just so wonderful. That's so nice to get these books when you read fantasy sometimes.
Speaking of a great hunting things, we have some live.
Do you want to pass that one back to the person who asked that last question, please?
Yep. There's some good stuff here.
Pointing at Bevan's pile when you said that, Jane?
They've already gone, though.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much.
You asked a question. Who are you? Yeah, somebody at the back asked it. When do you want to... How are you on Terry Goodkind?
My son loves it.
Well, okay, have a Terry Goodkind. We've run out of time. I want to leave you with one sentence only of this. Breathing deeply, he drank in the atrium the fragrance of Daphne that the Queen had personally planted in boxes hanging from the archway, and took a long, sorrowful look at the light-drenched gardens below she had tended and made so beautiful. Again, this is the professionally edited and published work of a professionally edited soul cop. So when it comes down to the last analysis, don't worry about writing quality.